is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Earlene McMichael. On Wednesday, May 22nd, preeminent astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson will hit the stage at Miller Auditorium. He's become a pop culture figure for his ability to excite people about science. Today, we replay my telephone interview with him that originally aired on April 15th. Neil deGrasse Tyson hosts two shows, Cosmos and Star Talk. Cosmos was originally hosted by the late Carl Sagan, who too became famous for his skill at making complex concepts understandable. Welcome to WMUK.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Where I'd like to start the conversation is a tweet that you just posted. And the tweet is a video that's almost about 5 minutes, and it's entitled Science in America. And you have never been shy about addressing controversial subjects. You said, still perhaps the most important words I have ever spoken. The video has you in it. It seems like it posits that America is the great industrial country that it is due to science and scientific breakthroughs. However, you're saying it feels to me that science just isn't getting the respect that it should get from the nation's leaders, and people who lead the country should know more about science. You're saying that scientific law is scientific law. It's nothing to be argued with. So why spend time debating it when you could be solving the issue? What did you mean in there? The video references vaccines, I think global warming. What did you mean?
So I don't think I talk about anything controversial at all. It's that I mention...
You say leaders of the country.
Watch.
That's politics.
Watch. So I'm reminded of a quote, I think it was from Harry Truman, because his moniker was Give Him Hell, Harry, right? And they said, Harry, why are you always giving people hell? He says, no, I tell them the truth, and they think it's hell. That's what he says. So I don't say controversial things. I say scientifically established objective truths. If you have, for whatever reasons of your politics, of your economics, of your religion, of your culture, decide to make that part of a political platform, then you have politicized science. And then people fight each other, and then you're fighting over something that is objectively known to be one way or another. And you should, if you're going to fight in the traditional political sense, you should be starting with what is objectively true, and then debate what you do about that.
What are the issues that you feel people are debating that shouldn't be debated right now?
Whether humans are the cause of the rise in CO2 and thereby creating a rapid change in our climate, the likes of which Earth has never seen. It's the rate at which it's changing. We've had change of climate like forever. It goes on all the time in the billions of years of Earth's history. It's the rate at which things are changing that we are not equipped to accommodate. Cities are not on wheels where you can roll them inward as the ocean levels rise. Do you realize if we lose the water that is currently locked in glaciers on tentatively locked in glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland, that the ocean levels would rise to the level of the Statue of Liberty's left elbow. So this is the elbow that's holding the Declaration of Independence, not the one holding the torch. So it's not as bad as what it would be if it hit the other elbow, which is raised above our head. But just picture that. And most cities of the world, and indeed some entire nations, are at sea level or just not very high above sea level. And why are nations, why are cities at sea level? Because that was great for commerce and shipping, and they're on river banks, and it made sense, and it still makes sense for that. All the great cities are positioned this way. So if you're going to debate this, you are losing valuable time where we could actually be solving the problem.
I have a couple of Carl Sagan questions. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued in doing a little research on you that at age 15, you were already lecturing. And what blew my mind is that Carl Sagan recruited you to attend Cornell. How did you come to his attention?
Yes.
We didn't have the internet then.
No, we did not. This is like snail mail and really slow communications. And I had applied to Cornell, had been accepted, and had not decided whether I would attend or not. And the admissions office, unbeknownst to me, sent my application to him for his reaction. And I'd known long before I even knew that Carl existed that I was interested in the universe. For me, it traces to back when I was 9 years old. So, but by then, though this is a zillion years ago, Carl was already famous. He'd already been on The Tonight Show, and he'd already written books, had not yet done Cosmos, where he would then become more famous. But famous enough, so I knew that, and I knew who this man is. And what happened? I get a letter in the mail addressed to me, signed by him, inviting me to the campus to help me decide whether I would then attend college at Cornell. And I said, sure enough, I went up there on a Saturday and took the bus from New York City up to Cornell. This was in December, and he met me, and this is, you know, school's not in session, right? It's Saturday. He met me at the building, came out, let me in. We went up to his office, and I'll never forget, he reached behind him and pulled a book off the shelf, didn't even look, and it was one of his books. I thought, now that's badass right there. You don't even have to look, and you pull a book off the shelf. It's your... And he signed it to me. I still have it. It says, to Neil Tyson, future astronomer. And I toured the labs. And I'm on my way home at the end of the day, and it begins to snow, as it does so often at Cornell in December. And he said, if the bus doesn't come through, here's my home phone number. Call. You can stay with the family and leave tomorrow. That was my first encounter with him.
And that wasn't impressive enough for you.
Well, no, I'm just saying, to attend Cornell. That's what you're saying.
I mean, no. Come on. Who gets that?
Okay, so I'm thinking... No, I'm being impressed not with Cornell, the school, which I could justifiably have been by this exchange. I'm impressed with this man and the fact that he doesn't know me from anything. I'm just some kid from the Bronx, age 17. I'm 17 at this visit. And he devotes this much time to me. To this day, if a student calls me and wants to talk or talk about a future, to say, I will make time for them to the exclusion of all else that might be going on in my life. The president's on the phone. Look, Barack, I'll get back to you. I got a student at the door. You know, this is, so I've had that level of directive, that level of mission statement burning within me ever since then.
One more Carl Sagan question. So you took over his show, Cosmos, that he mm-hmm. started, kind of the remake of it, so to speak. It's been very popular. So mm-hmm. how did it feel to step into his shoes?
So I don't think about it that way. I mean, I guess one could think about it that way, but that's not how I thought about it. I thought to myself, if I step into his shoes, I will fail because there's only one Carl Sagan, and he did it his way. And I know I could do it my way, right? There's my manners, there's my gesturing, there's my way that I pronounce words, I can do it my way. And if I am to fail, I would rather fail having attempted it my way than trying to be somebody else. So and by the way, the common denominator among the Cosmos is Anne Druyan, a very creative, brilliant writer and producer and of late also director, and she's highly scientifically literate and highly scientifically enlightened. And so, and she not only knows science, she feels science. So she's been co-writer on all the Cosmos, the original one, the one in 2014, the next one that will come out. And so part of it is writing in a way where you can get the most out of the emotion and the intellect of who is delivering the content. And so it's a collaboration of deliverer and writer, and there's set design, there's music, there's all the rest of this. So no, I said, I can't be him, but I know I can be me. I can do a really good version of me, and let's see if that works. And I think it did work, and I was certainly happy with how that came out.
You've been listening to a West-Southwest interview with famed astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. One of the things that you're known for, and Carl Sagan was known for it as well, but really connecting with general audiences, being able to really break down complex topics. I am curious, did you just kind of fall into it, or this was a deliberate choice on your part?
No, I was pulled into it. The forces operating. I live in New York City, which is a big news gathering headquarters of the nation and of the world, especially after CNN moved a branch here from Atlanta. And so now CNN is here, ABC, NBC, CBS. Of course, we have our local PBS affiliate and NPR. So what happened was the universe would flinch, and they'd send a camera or a reporter to my office, because I have title here. Initially, just simply director of the planetarium. And they didn't know me from anything, but they put the title of who it is, and so they get the guy who should be the expert. And so there I am giving my answers, and I noticed that they would edit the answers into these little sound morsels. And I thought to myself, if that's what they're going to do to my best professorial reply, then I should formulate sound morsels and hand them that. Then they'll be the exact sound morsels that I want them to be, and what do they want? And aside, they want it to be tasty. They want it to be. They want to smile. They want it to be so interesting that you might want to share it with someone else. That's the anatomy of a soundbite. And so I said, if I'm going to spend time giving interviews at all, I should at least be the best I could be at that. And so I practiced the sound bites. Then when I was invited to go on talk shows, I would study the host and say, how long do they let you speak before they interrupt? If it's a comedic host, before they interrupt you with a joke. If it's a newscaster, how long will they, what arc of questions do they typically take? Do they ask how it relates to current events or not? And I'd be pre-ready for such encounters. And I do all of this. And you know what happens? People see me on TV and they say, oh, you're so natural. It's like you have no idea how much effort I put in to looking natural. So, no, this was an earned sort of exercise in what excites people. What can I say that will excite people, that will get them to want to hear more? And this is what goes on in public talks that I give. The public talks I give, you know, they're typically not in lecture halls anymore. They're in like theaters or auditoriums, and it's the sum of my life experience communicating science to people and monitoring, are they looking sleepy, or are their eyebrows raised, are they beaming, are they look bored, and I adjust what I say and how I say it to serve what I know is a deep curiosity within them. So I'm there to stimulate your curiosity, not to squash it.
In your Cosmos series, one of the things you touch on is the intersection of science and religion. And here in America, you know, that's a contentious topic. Do you believe that faith in a higher power is at all incompatible with scientific understanding of the universe? Or are they asking two different questions?
Well, the cop-out answer is, though, they're asking two different questions. That's what Stephen Jay Gould wrote about. Rock of Ages, I think, was the name of his book, where he talked about non-overlapping magisteria. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that word correctly. Just saying, oh, they ask different questions, and so why try to have one combat the other? That's a bit of a cop-out in the sense that for most of the history of religion, as science rose up, science investigating the world using the methods and tools that were hard-earned and long-developed would find things that conflicted with what you derived from Scripture, for example. And now what do you do? If Scripture is unerring, this is particularly an issue with monotheistic religions, not with polytheistic religions. The Greeks had no issues with fickle, imperfect gods. In fact, they all were fickle and imperfect. But once you have a perfect, unerring, all-powerful, all-knowing, monotheistic religion, and there's a book ascribed to them that makes statements about the physical world, and you derive what is an understanding of the physical world from those scriptures, and then science shows them to be wrong, now you got to deal with that. So what are you going to do? What modern enlightened religious people do is say, I'm not going to get science out of my Bible. Modern Christians, for example, or Jews, there's an emergent sort of enlightened Islamic class that's also doing that with the Quran. But if you go a little deeper to those who are committed to the words, they assume it to be unerring. and they'll say that the science is wrong or that they have to reinterpret the religious text in some other way so that it does not conflict with science. But in either case, science is moving on. So it's a conflict if you have to get your knowledge of the natural world from your religious texts. If not, then everything's just fine.
The Trump administration's 2020 budget for NASA includes funding to return humans to the moon within the next 10 years and then on to Mars. How realistic do you think that timeline is?
It's ambitious. I don't mind ambitious timelines. I can tell you that if you have an ambitious timeline, there needs to be a strong motivator to enable it. And at this moment, I don't see strong motivators other than let's do this. And why do we originally go to the moon? We're now in the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And as Americans, we like to sort of cleanse the memory of the causes and effects of things and say, well, we're Americans and we're explorers and we're discoverers. So, of course, we went to the moon. That is not why we went to the moon. We went to the moon because we were being threatened by a force. And that force was the Soviet Union, who had conflicting social, cultural, religious, and political mission statements. They were all godless atheists. We're God-fearing Americans. They had an economic system that is socialist, and we are not that. And if they beat us at something, that would mean that their system is better than ours, and we can't make that happen. We can't allow that to happen. So they were beating us in practically everything that mattered in space. They had the first space. They had the first satellite. They had the first non-human animal. They had the first human. They had the first space station. Before that, they had the first woman in space. They had the first black person in space, a Cuban communist. They had the first space station. And we said, oh my gosh, we got to beat them at something. Let's beat them to the moon. So we get to the moon first and we say, we win. We won. And so all I'm saying is, if we're going to go back to the moon and on to Mars, just simply saying you want to do it, my read of history tells me, is insufficient enough cause to make that happen. But if China said, oh, we're going to put military bases on Mars, we're going to Mars.
So what you're saying is what we need is a little competition in that area, and all of a sudden that's going to become a priority.
Not just competition, threats.
Oh, okay, threats.
Threats to your way of life. This is why we went to the moon. There's threats. Okay, our very existence, our very understanding of ourselves flowed out of our ability to be better at the Russians at a whole suite of various things. And so that's what it comes down to. And so I'm skeptical of the timeline if there isn't other drivers for it. But if within that timeline, China says we're going to put stuff on Mars or on the moon, yeah, we're going. Definitely.
As we're talking about space science, what do you think is going to be the most momentous discovery or space exploration milestone that young people today will see in their lifetimes?
So what's good about when you're doing astrophysics is you know missions that are planned 5-10 years in advance. And these are missions that would then be looking for things that you want to find. And so I can say we're looking for life in the solar system outside of the Earth. I think the next generation will be alive for that discovery, and we have missions planned to do just that. They're not launched yet, but we want to look for life where we find water in the solar system. There are moons of Jupiter that have liquid water beneath a frozen, icy surface. Water has been liquid for billions of years. All evidence shows that life on Earth began in our oceans. So could there be life in the oceans of these objects, in these moons of Jupiter? So and other places. There's a moon of Saturn, for example, that is intriguing. So you add all of these up and you say, yeah, I want to discover life off of the Earth that could transform biology in ways that we might not even be able to foresee or imagine.
You've been listening to a West Southwest interview with famed astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Well, very clearly, you're an accomplished man. You're a director of the Hayden Planetarium. You have, what, at least 18 doctorates, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, 21 just recently, yeah.
21.
Okay. Oh, can I tell you about the honorary doctors? No, just so I can put this out there.
Okay.
People say, you have 21 honorary doctors, but you only have one real doctorate, right? That's how people commonly would refer to that. And then the head of NASA once told me, okay, the head of NASA 3 heads ago, once said, don't poo-poo the honorary doctorates. Those who don't know, each year many degree-granting universities will invite a select number of people to give an honorary doctorate, and then they're an honorary graduate of that school. It's all part of the ritual of graduation, and it's fun, and it's okay. So what he said was, your original doctorate is given to you on the expectation that you will do great things. The honorary doctorates are the affirmations that you have.
And you said?
I said, whoa. That puts it in a whole other light. And so then I started feeling better about your
honorary doctorate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's where I was going with that. This was just a lead up to another question, which is to say that on your own merit, of course, that you've achieved greatness, but you're also an African-American man. And so I was curious, you know, has race ever been a factor in your career? Has it ever held you back? Have you ever encountered any stigma because of it? And how have you worked around that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do a little bit of this in my memoir from the mid-2000s. I wrote it. There's a chapter called Dark Matters, right? where I highlight some of these stories. So here's what happened. My parents trained me and my siblings to, you know, how to react to a world whose forces were not aligned with our ambitions. And this would start with, what do you do when the police pull you over? Okay? It's like they always need to see your hands. They always need, so they don't shoot you in the back or shoot you in any direction. You say, yes, sir, no, sir. And so there's, how do you behave when you're stopped by the cops? Okay? That was ingrained in us since I said, you know, why would I ever be stopped by the cops? And they said, just do this, right? And of course, we've seen the consequences of if you don't do exactly certain ways as a black man, unarmed black man, in the presence of trigger-happy cops. Okay, so I'm alive possibly to this day for that reason. All right, continuing, there will be people who will stand in your way of where you want to go. Just walk around them, go over them, dig under them. They're a hurdle. And, you know, what does a track person do on the track when they see a hurdle? They jump over it. That's the whole point of the contest, is to jump over the hurdle. So there'll be these hurdles. So today, what people might refer to as microaggressions or even macroaggressions on anything about you that might make you different from others, be it a handicap or if you're female in a male-dominated world or you're a minority in a majority world, whatever it is, there are microaggressions. In my day, first, that term didn't exist yet. By the way, it's a great term. Didn't exist yet. But everything that would have been called a microaggression then, my parents instilled within us that it should be used as a source of inspiration to achieve. You feed it back into the fuel tank, and you say, this person thinks I'm not going to achieve. Well, I'm going to achieve that much greater because of it. And so in the sense of holding me back, I turned it around and made it fuel for success.
I guess what I'm asking is, did you in fact encounter anything?
Oh, yeah, weekly. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I just was wondering if people treated you like an anomaly, that you were the exception, so they did not treat you poorly in any way. But you said weekly you encountered things, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. In the 60s and 70s and going to college in Boston, that's one of the most racist towns at the time. It still has some issues.
Can you give an example of where you encountered that? Was it in the academic setting? Was it in just walking around the town?
Well, it's life. It's every, yes, academically as well. It's people. So it's, and by the, some of it is subtle. This is why they would count as microaggressions. So, for example, teachers in high school, and I went to an elite high school. Teachers in high school, which I went to the Bronx High School of Science. I was born and raised in the Bronx. A public school, you take a test to get into it, and then there's a cutoff, and you above the cutoff or below. Okay. But the school boasts 8 Nobel laureates among its graduates. That's as many as the country of Spain, just to put this in context. So it's an intellectually rich environment. So I'm there, and people are making suggestions that I join the basketball team or I do some athletics after school. I say, no, I'm going to be in the physics club. Oh, no, but you're so athletic. These are people making suggestions to me, thinking they're doing me a favor, because they don't see me as an academic. They don't see me liking physics or being good at math. It is not in their worldview. So I can try to fight it, or I can just navigate around it. And that's exactly what I did. And so then, okay, so I did all these things outside of school, by the way. I I went to Africa to view a total solar eclipse and part of a scholarship with the Explorers Club. I did research on Stonehenge and other stone monuments as part of another scholarship that I won while I was in high school. It had nothing to do with high school curriculum. This was outside of that. I was part of the astronomy club in my community. I took photos of the night sky. I loved photography. I took photos that I sold it to the local newspaper on community matters. I did all these things. No one in school knew this. So what happens? I have a sort of average grade point average, right? It's good, but not great. But I have all these other things. I get admitted to Harvard, and people assume that I'm in because I'm black, okay? Because someone else didn't get in with a higher GPA, okay? So then people get angry, and then there's resentment for that, which was odd, I thought, because didn't they know that admission at these schools is sort of a holistic thing? It's like, what else have you done? And what do you do? What do you do with your spare time? What have you accomplished? What have you done? And so all of this is part of my record that they knew nothing about. And 25 years later, the Harvard, one of the alumni magazines, makes a list of what they call the Harvard 100, which is the living graduates, most significant living graduate. And I'm in that list. Okay. So it's just they saw in me something that I saw in myself. And my energy for learning, my energy for being active, my energy for doing things. And most of your life is going to be about doing things, not about studying to get a grade on an exam. And someone in the admissions office caught that and knew it. And so fortunately, there are people who see past skin color and look on to what else you are. And without it, I could just be left in the streets. But you need some critical mass of them out there. Otherwise, you really, you know, it won't help to try to jump over the hurdle, because the hurdle just grows as you try to jump over it. So, yeah, there are examples. Most recently, more recently, I was in Boston, and this is not when I was a kid. I'm already established. I was hosting a TV series for PBS Nova, Nova Science Now, it was called. And this was a meeting with some potential donors, and I was the I was the guest of honor for this meeting. And PBS Nova is run out of Boston, WGBH, of course, the PBS, famous PBS affiliate. So it's hosted by a wealthy person who's on the board. And so he's got some very fancy apartment in a fancy building, doorman building overlooking the bay. And I'm coming up to this building in a taxi coming from the train station. And the taxi pulls up to the front of the building. The doorman comes out and says, "You can't stop there." And I said, "Why not? This is off limits. You can't stop there." And I said, is the floor going to collapse underneath the car? I'm trying to think rationally about why this is a physical impossibility that we shouldn't stop there. But we said, okay. So we pulled ahead, and the taxi driver let me off 20 feet ahead of this spot. Meanwhile, another taxi comes in, and the doorman opens the door, and it's somebody who lives there. And it occurred to me, the doorman didn't want just some random black person taking up the space in front of his building that he's protecting from all the people who live inside of it. And so I, upon realizing this, walked up to him. Now, I'm not one who starts fights, but I said I was the person in that taxi trying to get into this building, just to let you know, okay? And then he looked a little sheepish and then opened the door, and I went in, and I alerted the resident of the, you know, it was a well-known wealthy person who was on the board raising money for PBS. So this was a subtle thing, but it's still there, and it's still in people. And it's he assumed that I had no business at that building at all. And by the way, I'm in a jacket and tie, right? So these are the kinds of things, and it's all the time. It's, you know, if I fly first class, someone, you know, the flight attendant says, "Oh, the luggage racks are full. You have to check your luggage." I say, "I'd be disappointed to learn that in my first class seat, I don't have room for this luggage." "Oh, sorry, sir. Oh, you're first class." Okay. It's the assumptions that people make. And it used to be daily. It's now kind of weekly, or maybe twice a month. That's what it is. I live with it. It's Same stuff, different day. That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, I would be remiss if, as a journalist, I did not ask you the following question. So here we go. In recent months, Fox Broadcasting and National Geographic had put a hold on some of your shows that you host, Fox's Cosmos, Star Talk on National Geographic, due to sexual misconduct accusations that have been raised against you, with details ranging from inappropriate comments and physical contact with colleagues, all the way to drugging and raping a fellow graduate school classmate. I know you've addressed this on Facebook, but for this interview, could you address those allegations? I know that they've continued to allow you on the show.
Yeah, I don't adjudicate these matters in the press. That's the wrong place for any of that to happen. So, there are investigations, and the Fox investigation is done. The shows are going back on the air. They're already airing. So, part is done.
Right. Well, I believe in a Facebook post, I guess it was a pretty long one, that you, as far as the touching and the comments, you described them as harmless gestures. And would that be about right?
I'm not adjudicating this in the media. I'm not doing it. I have nothing to add or subtract from my Facebook post, and you have the results of the Fox investigation. That's it.
And just one more thing. This is just more a factual thing. I was reading a story in the New York Times, and it said that as far as the American Museum of Natural History, where you direct the Hayden Planetarium, that they're still doing an investigation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
mm-hmm.
The listeners would say, hey, I was softballing you if I didn't ask that question, so I must ask it. I guess one final question.
Well, you're not softballing if the point of this is to talk about the universe and about a talk I'm giving.
Right.
That's the point of it. If the point is, you can say the point of it would be other things, and then you would be, if you were an investigative reporter and then you didn't ask me, then you would be accused of softballing for sure.
Right.
But this was not an investigative interview. It was just for just talk about the universe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's close on this, unless you can think of another question. Mm-hmm. You're known for exciting the public about science. What in science has excited you?
I like most the standing on the edge of what we know, looking out into this great abyss of ignorance that confronts an active research scientist every day. So just as a point of reference there, it's not uncommon to see a journalistic piece that begins with the sentence or some version of a sentence that says, this new result will send scientists back to the drawing board. Well, if you're an active research scientist, you're always at the drawing board. You're never sitting with your legs up on the desk saying, oh, we know everything. No. If you're on the frontier, everything is unknown, or most things are unknown. That's what the frontier means. That's why you've cut through the brush and bramble of what is known to get to that point, to look out and say, what should my next question be? I don't even know that, let alone what is the answer to something that I've already, to a question I've already posed. So for me, I thrive on staring into the ignorance of the moving frontier of astrophysics. And that would include not knowing what dark matter is, dark energy is, what's around before the universe, is there life elsewhere in our solar system or in the galaxy? Is there intelligent life somewhere else? These are important questions which, when answered, are profound, will be profound. But what would be more profound is the question I don't even yet know to ask, because it would only arise for having discovered something that we're looking for now.
So what excites you is you tend to be more future-oriented than looking back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love looking back to see how people, you know, twisted and turned to come to understandings of things. That's very important. And humbling, by the way, because whatever you do today, you get big-headed about it. Yeah, I got this right. Well, take a look at these really smart people who thought they had it right but then had it wrong. So what does that mean in the moment? So the history is a very important part of how I think and how I establish steps, next steps to move forward.
So there's no singular thing in science that just like, hey, it just blew your mind. It blew your socks off.
No, a lot in astrophysics blows my socks off all the time. So that's, we expect that.
Oh, okay.
We expect our dose of socks blowing content multiple times a year. And so that's kind of what's fun when you're on such a big frontier, a frontier that is as big as the universe itself. So, yeah, I think I'm quoted somewhere as saying, you should have your mind blown daily. Otherwise, it's a wasted day. So a daily is hard. That's a hard number to match. Maybe weekly. Definitely weekly. Try to make that happen weekly. And if it's not, it means you could be reading more or seeing more documentaries or reading more books, and because that's where the mind-blowing stuff can be found.
Are your socks blown weekly?
I try to. For me, it's probably seasonally.
Okay. Well, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, excellent. And thanks for that interest.
Neil deGrasse Tyson delivers a presentation titled Astronomy Bazaar on May 22nd at Miller Auditorium. West Southwest is produced by WMUK, the public radio station licensed to Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. You can subscribe to the podcast through Apple iTunes and Google. There, you can leave a rating and a review. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.